Thank you, Bradley. There are these moments when I find myself unsure whether to congratulate somebody or to offer my condolences. You know? One of my... I'm sorry. Is that what somebody said? Congratulations. I teach a capstone for senior students graduating out with their social and anthro degrees. And one of the students, put your hands in the air. My neck doesn't do that anymore. Sorry.
2016.
That's my daughter disrupting the sermon right now. Thank you. I appreciate that. And she's in that capstone class. But one of the students in that, getting back on track, my dear daughter, Kimberly. pardon me. One of the students was at my office, really excited. She got a job for the summer. You know, was going to start out and get some work experience. Like, what are you doing? She says, I'm working as an assistant for behavioral therapy. Great. Good for you. Now, she's going to be working with, it's her first experience out doing field work, doing behavior therapy for autistic young people. Yeah. Spectrum disorder. Isn't that fun, Rick?
Yeah.
Isn't that fun, Arbuckles?
It's very necessary.
Okay. Note the adjective used here. It's very what?
Necessary.
Necessary. Now, is that fun, exciting, thrilling, joyful, peaceful, satisfying, rewarding? Note the qualifier, the subordinate clause, can be. Can be. You know, going to the dentist can be relieving. Okay, right? So that's what you want to do for your summer, right? No. It's just that it's a really tough field. That field, bless you, that means something. We're in church and I'm ordained. You just want blessings. That field, I've had a bit of experience with it, assisted with classes for folks with autism and stuff, and that is just tough work. Because,
that's right. Is going, that's right, that's what I do every day, behavioral work, trying to get them to respond. What's the primary difficulty that you find? Yeah. Lots of comorbidity. Not elope or scream when you're trying to help them, correct? See, that's the thing. The rest of us in education, we've got it easy, you know. And normally I tend to complain about the job in education, but it's easy compared to that because we can rely on ordinary interpersonal skills, that there's going to be some sort of social interaction, some sort of social attachment there, that an ordinary communication response, like, no, you can't turn in your paper. And they don't lay on the ground and scream a fit or elope when that happens. They don't just abandon the situation. But you can't rely on that with a spectrum disorder. In fact, that's the problem. That's because that is the problem. The problem is that ordinary sense of, okay, we understand the world that we're living in and what we're doing here, at least to some degree, and we are communicating as ordinary human beings communicate, is gone, or at least impaired. That's why it's a spectrum, that it's impaired to a varying degree. That I think I'm talking to you, but you might be somewhere else, hearing something else. And where you are is inside you. Far away inside you. That's the very root of the idea of autism from Greek autos, right? So an automobile is what? A Yes, it can move by itself. Automobile, autos. Autos means self. And somebody with autism is somebody who's to themselves. That's just it. It's this hyper-expression of that isolation that is characteristic of all human beings. That to some degree, all of us are trapped inside these little bone bunkers and can't get out. And we normally use remote controls fairly effectively, you know. We have our cameras, we have our microphones, we have our, you know, our little, I don't know, manual controls for our remote arms. We have our speakers. But when that link gets somehow impaired, when there's static in the system, then someone ends up trapped in their bunker and the signals going in and out aren't right. And they get this hyper-expressed individuality. It's just an overblown characteristic of our ordinary isolation, our insularity as human beings. They live in their own worlds. They have their own priorities. They have their own ways. They have their own values. It's like the value system is all skewed. What's really valuable? This little trinket upon which I've obsessed. You know, what is it? It's a stir stick. But that stir stick becomes the most important thing in the world. What's the most important thing? That bright light. That flashing thing. What's the most important thing to do right now? To rock. I'm not going there. But there are these values and behaviors at play that are unique to one's own self, and they can't be breached except with tremendous effort, tremendous extension. And even then, if you make a little break and you can get in there and maybe get a little flash of something other than selfhood, it might make a little scratch. And then what happens? It evaporates like it's gone, right? She says it's gone. It's like a drawing on an etch-a-sketch in the middle of an earthquake. You know? You're trying to draw, or you know, in a Jeep. You're in a Jeep doing etch-a-sketches. That's it. And it's like, what happens to my drawing all the time? That's the problem. How many of you have heard of a guy named Bruno Bettelheim? Okay, good. Okay. Well, that's a great example. Just so you know that, think about Bruno. No. Bruno Bettelheim was a professor of psychology at University of Chicago for many, many years. And Bettelheim had been through, his original training was in Vienna, and he had been through Dachau during the Nazi occupations, had been allowed out on a... They let some prisoners out of Dachau for Hitler's birthday. Okay, now there's enough twistedness there for an entire series. But he got out and ended up in America eventually. And he posited originally that autism was caused by what he called refrigerator moms. In other words, they were cold and they didn't give enough attachment to the child. And because attachment was all the rage then, attachment would cure everything. And he posited that given the right affirming milieu, that they would come out of it. And so he tried that therapy a lot. And although his theories now have been discredited because it appears that there's just something wrong in the mechanism of what's going on up here, he saw a parallel because he had been through tremendous traumatic situations. And he saw a parallel between people who had been traumatized or had that human touch withdrawn, and the kinds of effects that autism has. Because there's nothing like pain to make you close to yourself. You ever notice that when you're in pain, you know, you're not really concerned with the people around you, and you're that thing, if you are stepping on a thumbtack, okay, it's very hard to get you distracted from that thumbtack to do your work. If you've ever had something in your eye while you're driving, right? You know you're doing something that is deadly out there. But that's not what has your attention. What has your attention is that
that speck of something in your eye, and you become very close to yourself. So he saw something that's valid there, even though his etiology or his source theory was flawed, because that's what that kind of pain does to you. It draws you in and makes you individual very frequently. Very hard to reach out when there's something bugging you. I share this because it happened openly, and the person has said that she's okay to share it openly. In one of my classes at Fuller, we had this very, very interesting moment, a very poignant moment. We were talking about the image of God in human beings and what that implies, that God made humankind male and female in his image, and what that implies for sexuality in our culture and in our day, that there's something about the nature of God, his image, that is accomplished and fulfilled in male and female relationship. He made it to be that way. And that there's a distortion that takes place when that different unity, that unity and difference, heterogeneous unity, compound unity of unlike things, when that's changed to like things, that's morally questionable from a Christian viewpoint. In fact, morally rejectable from a Christian viewpoint. And somebody in the back said, does that mean that you have to believe in Jesus in order for that morality to obtain on you? And I said, no. Morality obtains on people who don't believe in it. Take, for example, a scenario of a sixth grade teacher in love with a 12-year-old student. You know? Yeah, but across cultures, throughout many societies, people come of age at 12 or 13. You know? A bar mitzvah, a bat mitzvah. In Arab society, you're an adult at 12, right? If you're Latin society, you get a couple more years, you're an adult at 15. Biology is already saying that it's okay. Biology says, yeah, you're ready to reproduce. And yet we from the outside make a judgment. We have to make a judgment that is not allowable and that it's wrong, even though they might be protesting from inside the relationship that they're experiencing it as care, even though they might be protesting that it is wrong. Or that it is right and okay and loving. We from the outside say it is wrong and unloving. And we define that over against their voices. So you got the scenario? The gal goes, I disagree. Like, you disagree? Okay. And she says, I disagree. That's not love. And I said, that's what I'm saying. That's not love. That we make that judgment from the outside that it's not love. She goes, I disagree. She says, as someone who has been through that, both I and my sister, all of our lives growing up, I'm saying that's not love. And I said, that's what I'm saying. That we make that judgment, even though the people inside protest. And she goes, no, 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 no. We went on that. For a while, and I said, you know, let's talk about this some more. She goes, okay. But I went on with the lecture. She sent me an email. I can't believe that you would say those things in class. I'm like, I was agreeing with you. You were agreeing with me. No, we weren't. I don't agree. And took a number of conversations to finally get that iron out, and then at one point, when I'm sitting down, we made a powwow. I brought in a third party just to say, okay, let's get a third voice on this. And when the third party said, you know, I think he's saying what you're saying. She said, really? Is that what you're saying? I said, yes, that's what I'm saying. And I repeated myself. She says, oh. You see, when there's enough noise in the system, if there's enough distraction and noise in the system, you can be looking right at somebody and telling them, I love you, or I want to care for you. But if there's enough noise in the system, they might hear something completely different. So you're saying, I want to help you, and the person screams. The autistic person experiences trauma where there is none and fails to experience pain when they should. And that's frequently what happens when we're in ourselves. Our interpretive schemata, our way, our perceptions end up so fixed that the message can't get across, no matter how forcefully or clearly it's said or performed. We keep saying, "I disagree." Last week, for those of you who haven't been here, we've been dealing with a series, God's Vinyl, Songs in the Scripture. And last week, we heard a little ditty about David and Saul, David's leitmotif, his theme in the Scripture. And it's repeated a number of times in the book of 1 Samuel. And we started to explore a little bit of the kind of trouble that caused between him and Saul, his father-in-law, and the king at that time. And I wanted to explore a little bit further today. We don't have time to go through the whole David and Saul cycle, but there are a number of points that I want to highlight. So if you would turn, pardon me, to 1 Samuel 16. Isn't it cool to hear a little baby in the middle of church? It's like hearing birds outside. It's so cool. It's like, First Samuel 16. Oh, that's awesome. Look down at verse 14. Now, the Spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul. And imagine how shocking that would have felt. I don't know if any of you have ever had a moment in which, after becoming a Christian, suddenly the Spirit of the Lord was silent. But that is a traumatic and scary moment. If you've ever had a season where the Lord is silent, you know you want to keep listening from there on out. It says, and an evil spirit, this is a destructive kind of spirit, from the Lord tormented him. I don't know if you've ever been in inner torment, if you've had a painful scenario and you have been tormented inside. But sunny days aren't sunny. Light music isn't light. Jokes aren't funny. And Disney characters just annoy you. Saul's attendant said, I want to ask for a raise of hands, but you don't have to. But I would bet a number of people have experienced seasons of inner torment, where you're just tormented in spirit. And there's no relief. There's nothing that feels okay. It just grinds on you. It's like the very worst kind of ball of fire and ice in your stomach, and it just gnaws at you, and nothing feels okay. Saul's attendant said to him, look, an evil spirit from God is tormenting you. Now, there's a whole bunch of theological issues there we're not going to get into, but God, don't forget how sovereign God is. He is a lot broader and stronger than we tend to give him credit for. And if he can send the angel of death, like a Doberman on a choker chain, to take care of the Egyptians, he certainly can allow other creatures and go, yeah, send it. Let our Lord command his servants here to search for someone who can play the harp. He will play when the evil spirit from God comes upon him, and you will feel better. Sometimes in those torment times, have you ever turned on worship music? You're like, I just have to hear something holy. I just have to hear something sacred and hopeful. Even though it doesn't fix it, at least it's aloe on the sunburn of my soul. Saul said to his attendants, find someone who plays well and bring him to me. One of the servants answered,
I've seen a son of Jesse of Bethlehem who knows how to play the harp. He's a brave man and a warrior. He speaks well and is a fine-looking man. That's a great reference, you know, by the way.
Here's my resume. I wrote it myself. And the Lord is with him. That's the best qualifications. And then Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, send me your son David, who is with the sheep. So Jesse took a donkey loaded with bread and a skin of wine and a young goat and sent them with him, with his son David, to Saul. David came to Saul and entered his service. Saul liked him very much, and David became one of his armor bearers. Close attendant. Close attendant. Then Saul sent word to Jesse saying, allow David to remain in my service, for I am pleased with him. Whenever the Spirit from God came upon Saul, David would take his harp and play. Then relief would come to Saul. He would feel better, and the evil spirit would leave him. That's the background of David's relationship with Saul. David is someone who cared for Saul in his deepest distresses. When Saul was distorted inside. Have you ever tried to calm an autistic person? A lot. And you have to be very secure in the way you do it without freaking them out. Same way with, imagine a horse that has been beaten. And it's jittery and jumpy. That's Saul. And the only thing that would help is David saying, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to calm you. I'm going to wash your inner wounds over and over again. So much so that Saul said, I've got to keep you close. You're going to be my armor bearer, the one who's got my back, helps me get dressed for war. You're going to be part of my close bodyguard. You're going to be my man. You're my protege. And the story goes on. We're going to cover all the points, but the story goes on. He does the Goliath thing. He steps out in front when Saul is timid in the back. He becomes Saul's son-in-law. Saul says, it says that Saul put him over his officers and sent him out over these thousands. And all he defended Israel when the Philistines would come in. David is doing Saul's dirty work. When they first approach him about marrying Saul's older daughter, Merab, he says, I can't do it. I'm not worthy. I'll just serve. But eventually, he goes and has to pay a battle price as the bride price for Michal, Saul's younger daughter. He becomes Jonathan, Saul's favored son, becomes his best friend. So this guy's a friend of the family. This is the guy, the friend of your kids that has breakfast with you in your house, in your home, that stays over, that spends the time in your household, works at your business, drives you to the hospital to get your clinical reports, comforts you when you see that they're positive, plays you songs and sings you to sleep when you're tormented and can't sleep. But Saul can't hear it. What he's got in his head is the ditty. Saul has slain his thousands, David his 10,000s, and it just eats in him. He can't see David except through this lens of jealousy, envy, ambition, fear. And whatever David does, there's this shift in the filter that makes it a threat, even though it's an overture of care. He came over to my house. He wants my daughter. He has my daughter. He's my son's best friend. He's my son's best friend. He's taking my family away. And Saul can't get over his autism. His, I think, trauma-induced in some way, trepidation. David has been his champion. David has been his therapist. David has been his bard. David has been his son-in-law. David has been his victim. Eventually, Saul starts chasing David. It says that there's one time when Saul is tormented. David comes in to play the harp for him, and Saul throws a spear at him. David ducks and bails.
Talk about biting the hand that soothes you. Here's somebody trying to soothe Saul, and Saul can only see threat. Here's somebody trying to bring the presence of the Lord to Saul, and all Saul can be is afraid. It's that twitch that people, you know, you ever seen somebody who just is suspicious? They're fearful. Like, how are you doing? What? Don't hit me.
I just wanted to say hi.
Don't hit me! That's how Saul is with David. David says, let me take care. Don't hit me! I'm going to hit you back! I'll hit you before you hit me! I'll show you. He's twitched on the inside.
And it goes on and on and on. This goes on for chapter after chapter after chapter. We're not going to read them all.
So much so that David, as we saw last time, was driven away to the king of Gath. And he arrives at Gath and they say, oh, isn't this the guy that they say, Saul is slain his thousands, yeah, David his 10,000s, yeah. I don't need another one of these around me. But eventually he wins over the king of Gath, and we pick up the story in chapter 28.
I'm sorry, for chapter 27. Real quick.
But David thought to himself, one of these days, I will be destroyed by the hand of Saul. Best thing I can do is escape to that land of the Philistines. Then Saul will give up searching for me anywhere in Israel, and I'll slip out of his hand. So David and the 600 men with him left and went over to Achish, son of Maok, king of Gath. Again, that's where Goliath was from. David and his men settled in Gath with Achish. Each man had his family with him. David had his two wives, Ahinoam, son of Jezreel, and Abigail, Carmel, the widow of Nabal. When Saul was told that David had fled to Gath, he no longer searched for him. So David was right. David said to Achish, if I found favor in your eyes, let a place be assigned to me in one of the country towns that I may live there. Why should your servant live in the royal city with you? So on that day, Achish gave him Ziklag, and it's belonged to the kings of Judah ever since. David lived in the Philistine territory a year and 4 months. Now, David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Girzites, the Amalekites. From ancient times, these peoples had lived in the land extending from Shur and Egypt. Whenever David attacked an area, he didn't leave a man or woman alive, but took sheep and cattle, donkeys and camels and clothes, and returned to Achish. When Achish asked him, where'd you go? What'd you do? Were you raiding today? He'd say, against the Negev of Judah, or against the Negev of Jerahmeel, or against the Negev of the Kenites. So what he was doing is he was raiding inside the territory. So he was within the territory, and raiding the enemies of Judah and Israel, the Amalekites and the Girzites, the Gerethites. And then we would come back to Achish, who he's working for. Achish would say, so who have you been raiding? And he goes, oh, I've been pounding those Israelites. Negev means, it's the, like, high country, it's like Apple Valley. It's like that, the Negev. High desert. Kind of wilderness. Sometimes it's translated wilderness, Negev. Bless you. So the king would say, where have you been going? He says, I've been pounding the Israelites. And yet he's really been pounding the enemies of the Israelites. And he's been doing it inside the territory. So he's been playing this king Achish. It says verse 1 of chapter 28. In those days, the Philistines gathered their forces to fight against Israel. Achish said to David, you must understand that you and your men will accompany me in the army. So here's the real crux. The Philistines are going to go out to battle with Israel. The king of Gath says, you will accompany me in battle against the Israelites. They can't play the game anymore. Now it's really down to it. What do you think David's going to do? Huh? Oh, no. If you were David, what would you do? Now realize, you have tried to convince this guy who thinks you're out to get him. You've tried. When he, one time David was hiding in a cave and Saul came in to relieve himself. And David's men said, oh, this is from the Lord. David goes, you don't touch the anointed. And snuck up and cut off a piece of his robe as he's relieving himself. That's a sneaky guy. And then goes back and says, my Lord, look, against whom have you come out? Against a dead dog, against a flea. Know that you were in my hand and I did not touch you. And Saul had said, you're right, I'm wrong. Then another time, David and his men were up in a stronghold hiding, and Saul and the camp was there, and David snuck into the camp, and there was Saul sleeping, and he stole his water jug and his javelin and went back. And the guy with him said, one blow, and he will not get up. Let me do. And David said, no, you don't touch the man. He's anointed. Did the same thing. You know, you really ought to fire your secret service. Abner, you're worthy of death. You didn't protect your master. And same thing. Saul said, okay, I get it. You're not out to get me. I'm sorry. Is that your voice, David, my son? And he wept, it says. Now, you've tried to convince this guy. You've married his daughter. You're his son's best friend. You've defended him against every kind of enemy so far. You've shown him outright grace this many times when he has tried to kill you, all trying to convince him, hey, I am not trying to hurt you. And now you have to go out to battle against him and prove him right. What are you going to do? Achish said, you must understand that you and your men will accompany me in the army. David said, then you will see for yourself what your servant can do. There's a double meaning. Achish replied, very well. I'll make you my bodyguard for the rest of my life. And David's going, you certainly will. Now Samuel was dead, and all Israel had mourned for him and buried him in his own town of Ramah. And Saul, who's uptight, can't get a prophetic word, and he goes to a witch of all people, and Samuel gives him a word, says, you know, you shouldn't ask of me if the Lord's not answering you, but we'll talk about it tomorrow when you're dead with me. Yeah. Chapter 29, the Philistines gathered all their forces at Aphek, and Israel camped by the spring in Jezreel. As the Philistine rulers marched with their units of hundreds and thousands, David and his men were where? Marching as the rear guard. This is a perfect strategic setup. You got the Israelites in front and David and his men bringing up the rear in back. This has slaughter written all over it from David's perspective. He's going, yes. Now you guys are over there. Says, the commanders of the Philistines asked, what's with these Hebrews? Achish replied, isn't this David, who is an officer of King Saul of Israel? He's already been with me for over a year, and from the day he left Saul until now, I've found no fault in him. Yeah, that's right. You didn't find anything. But the Philistine commanders were angry with him and said, send the man back that he may return to the place you assigned him. He must not go with us to battle, or he will turn against us during the fighting. How better could he regain his master's favor than by taking the heads of our men? Isn't this the David they sang about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And Achish called David and said to him, as surely as the Lord lives, you have been reliable. And I would be pleased to have you serve with me in the army. From the day you came to me until now, I have found no fault in you, but the rulers don't approve of you. Turn back and go in peace and do nothing to displease the Philistine rulers. But what have I done? Asked David.
why have you found against your servant from the day I came to you until now? You didn't find me any bodies that I buried. Why can't I go and fight against the enemies of my lord, the king? Oh, there's a phrase. Why can't I go and fight against the enemies of my lord, the king?
Saul.
He says, no, you got to go back. So they go back. David has to take his men and leave. And as he's marching away, he knows. So here's your father-in-law, the guy you spent your life trying to support, going out to battle against a superior force, and you can't do a thing when you thought you could defend him. And the Israelites get slaughtered. Saul gets wounded, ends up taking his own life. Jonathan, slaughtered. Best friend of David, gone. David has to be marching the opposite direction. And he knows this is a bad scenario, and he's helpless to go help his father-in-law, his friend, his mentor, his best friend, and his own people. We pick up the story in 2 Samuel. After the death of Saul, David returned from defeating the Amalekites and stayed in Ziklag 2 days. On the third day, 3 days without knowing how the battle went, a man arrived from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and with dust on his head. When he came to David, he fell to the ground to pay him honor. Where have you come from? He asked. He answered, I've escaped the Israelite camp. Okay, anytime you say you escaped the camp, it's a bad indicator. What happened? David said. Tell me. He said, the men fled from the battle. Many of them fell and died. And Saul and his son Jonathan are dead. Now, that's pretty cold. Unless he thinks that David considers them enemies. This guy doesn't understand David's heart. Then David said to the young man who brought him the report, how do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead? I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, the young man said. There was Saul leaning on his spear and the chariots and riders almost upon him. When he turned around and saw me, he called out to me and I said, what can I do? He asked me, who are you? I'm an Amalekite, I answered. Bad. Then he said, stand over me and kill me. I'm in the throes of death, but I'm still alive. So I stood over him and killed him, because I knew that after he had fallen, he couldn't survive. And I took the crown that was on his head and the band on his arm, and I brought him here to my lord. And so I took his watch and his wallet and his cell phone, and I brought him to you. Because I know he was out to get you, and you hate him, right? See, there's blood right on him. That's why I stuck it in. He kind of went, ah! And I stuck it in. That's my father-in-law you're talking about there. Then David and all the men who with him took hold of their clothes and tore them. They mourned and wept and fasted till evening for Saul and his son Jonathan, and for the army of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they'd fallen by the sword. And David said to the young men who brought him the report, where are you from? I'm the son of an alien, an Amalekite, he answered. David asked him, why were you not afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? Then David called one of his men and said, go kill him. So he struck him down and he died. For David said to him, your blood's on your own head. Your own mouth testified against you when you said, I killed the Lord's anointed. And David took up this lament concerning Saul and his son Jonathan and ordered that the men of Judah be taught this lament of the bow, as it's written in the book of Jasher. Your glory, O Israel, lies slain on your heights. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon. Lest the daughters of the Philistines be glad. Lest the daughters of the uncircumcised rejoice. O mountains of Gilboa, may you never have neither dew nor rain
nor fields that offer offerings of grain. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul, no longer rubbed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the flesh of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan didn't turn back. The sword of Saul did not return unsatisfied. Saul and Jonathan, in life they were lovely and gracious, and in death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. How the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies slain on your hearts. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. How the mighty have fallen. How the weapons of war have perished. He says, oh, Saul, 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 Jonathan, I tried to let you know. I love you guys. I tried to let you know. I love you guys. He's just weeping and pouring his heart out. Misunderstood. Like being the sibling of an autistic child. Never able to get the point across. You know, I loved you. I loved you. I loved you. And I will always miss you. The great tragedy is that Saul never heard this song. He never heard the song. The even greater tragedy is that if he had heard it, he wouldn't hear it. David had sung to him 1,000 times and he didn't hear it.
It was just Saul's myopia, his nearsightedness.
For us today, couple of things. First off, there will be people in your life that you will say, I love you, and they will not hear it. There will be people in your lives that no matter how much you try to say, I'm here to comfort you, they will flinch. No matter how much you say, I love you, I am for you, they will not hear it. And you can be David, and you can marry the daughter and defend the man and comfort him, and you can't get it across. That's one of the frustrations of trying to love people, and the only thing you can do is grieve it like David did. On the flip side, there might be people in your life trying to tell you that they love you. And that thumbtack in your shoe might be keeping you from hearing that they love you. I encourage you, listen. Because you might have a David who's going, I'm trying to love you. And you might be saying, don't hit me. More than either of those, from Luke 13. Scripture says that the Lord appointed David as king because he was a man after God's heart. At the same time, the Pharisees came to Jesus and said, leave this place and go somewhere else. Herod wants to kill you. He said, you go tell that fox, I'll drive out demons and heal people today and tomorrow. And the third day, I'll reach my goal. In any case, I must keep going today and tomorrow and the next day. For surely no prophet can die outside Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you kill the prophets and you stone those sent to you. How often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. But you would not. want to tell you today that whatever conflicts you might have with the Lord, they are illusions. Whatever suspicions you might have about God's will for your life, whatever might be nagging at the back of your head, where you think God's going to hit you, that's autism running in your veins. All of those objections that society has about the Lord, saying God hates people. He just likes to keep them down. It's the rantings of a madman, a paranoid society, too obsessed with its own sinfulness to realize that God is saying, as he says in Romans 10, all day long have I stretched forth my hands unto a disobedient and back-talking people. Lord says, I love you. I love you. I love you. Love you. Why won't you hear me? Hear me. How many times would I have gathered you? I would have gathered you. The Lord wants to gather your soul and comfort your torment. I'll gather you. But you would not. This morning, we have one more way that the Lord has said, I love you. I want you to remember, I love you. I gave my body and my blood for you. I love you. I'm for you. As we prepare our hearts to come take the communion, I encourage you, like an autistic child who can't resist the urge to twitch or to run away or to not see the value, let the Lord comfort you, let the Lord relax your hearts, and come to his table. Come to his table and hear, I love you. So we can have the elders come up to the table. Please file up and say, Lord, I want to hear you say I love you. Take the elements, go back to your seat, and we will partake together.